Okay, now we can conclude the show and tell. So has anybody ever actually had access to this thing before? It's called a zip. It's a zip disk, and there used to be something called zip drives. The reason I mention this is that some of you, probably not all, remember that way, way back, in fact, going back, if you look at Mesh software, there's usually an icon on software to do a save of a file. But they don't put an S or anything in it. They put this little kind of squarish little blob on there. And does anybody know what that is supposed to be? A floppy disk. Because in the earliest days of computers, the only thing that you as a programmer on a personal computer had to save information was this floppy disk. And again, many of you may have seen this. It's much thinner than this. But it was very limited in capacity. It was something like a megabyte, I believe, was its capacity. But that was all you had. If you bought a new piece of software for the very earliest PCs, you would get a box, a pretty big one, with a whole series of floppy disks. Has anybody ever installed software off a floppy series of floppies? A few have, but most of you haven't. And there would be like 10 or 20 of these things. Insert floppy 1, insert floppy 2, and it would read, read, read. Then a little bit later, it turned out that hard drives, external hard drives, started to become available in maybe the vicinity of a couple hundred megabytes, 500 megabytes, not a gigabyte for sure. And floppies were really way too small. I mean, how would you fill up a couple of hundred megabyte drive off of floppies that had something of 1 megabyte each? So they brought these things out as essentially the successor. In fact, they kind of look like floppy drives. They're a little fatter. And where people used to have floppy drives, they would have these zip drives, and this one was zip 100, 100 megabytes. You could get them up to a couple of hundred megabytes, 250 or something. And eventually what happened is these gave way to optical drives, which we all have now. But it turns out that the optical drives came out about the same time as PCs and so on came out. But the companies that own the optical drives these days regret ever having given computer companies access to the patents. Does anybody know why? What happened in the earliest days, of course, what happened to optical drives, they were CDs. And most of you, you know, still know about CDs. You know, they're still around. They've been around, I think, since around the mid-80s. But they were owned by essentially music companies, companies like Sony and JVC and so on. And it turned out that the computer people decided, hey, wait a minute, we could store a lot of data on the optical drives because they're essentially being stored in bitwise form. And the companies gave computer companies the patent rights to go ahead and do that. But again, why do you think they regret that now? Because they thought about reading, but they never envisioned that people would come up with burnable CDs. As soon as people came up with burnable CDs, what happened? Yeah, people would copy them like crazy. I mean, why would you go out and buy, what would CDs cost in those, $10 or something in that range, when you could buy a blank drive for under a dollar, bank unit for under a dollar, push one in, do a burn, do another, and bingo, you got it. You could do your custom mixes and all that. So historically, we went on then to the optical drives that you're all still familiar with, and then, of course, flash drives now, which is the basis of flash memory and all that, and it's sort of interesting history of this thing. For a while, these things were hot as heck. The company that did this was iOmega, was one of the high flyers. People were spending huge amounts of money to buy iOmega stock. First rule, never buy into a company that has only one product. Because once that product goes, and you could go into any computer store, I don't think you could buy these. You'd have to go on the internet and buy it as a historical artifact. So anyway, it's kind of cool to show, you know, what's the famous line that you learned in school? Sic transit gloria mundi. Anybody studying Latin? What does sic transit gloria mundi mean? All fame is fleeting. Now you're on top today, like these guys were, and a little bit later, nobody remembers you. So it's something important to remember. By the way, anybody want this? Don't throw it away, but if you want to know something for your historical records, or if you see Judy, show Judy. I bet you once upon a time they used these here. Because for a while, they were really hot stuff, and there is feeling. At the end, if you want to come by and take it, just promise not to throw it away. Do something with it, because it's going to sit and gather dust, and eventually it'll be thrown away on my end, if not by me, by somebody who makes decisions for me. So I just thought I had to talk about that because it's a lesson you are all computer professionals and would care to know. So anyway, we were talking about classes, and classes now are really the basis for all programming in languages like Java and C# and other things. But in the beginning, classes were not called classes. They were called records or structs. Struct being an abbreviation for structure. And all they were was a way to group data together and put it into a package and give it a name. Now, the difference between records and structs, record goes back to, I think, the Pascal programming language, which was very early 70s, and struct goes back to C, which begins to C++, and so on. And the notion is that you could store a group of data that was homogeneous into an array. So you could have an array sub 100 of integers, or an array sub 100 of floats. But if I wanted to have something that mixed together types, I want to have, for example, some characters, for example, somebody's name, and some numbers like somebody's pay scale or social security number or so on, arrays wouldn't work. So people came up with records and structs, and essentially you would do something like struct and then just give what amounts of fields. So you'd have some sort of structure that puts together a field I and a field B with integer and Boolean, but we're assuming they're separate types, or something like float or whatever. So historically, structs, which evolved essentially in the classes, had no methods inside them. And the big step that really made made Java and languages that are class-based important goes back, I think, as far as a language called Simula 67, I think, back in 1967, was they said, hey, wait a minute. If we can put data inside of a structure, maybe we can also put code, procedures, functions, methods. And that's where they got the notion of then being able to say int f of int k with some code inside it. And that's what you're familiar with. They went from structs. Originally, you could have them in structs, and then they went to classes as a better name for it. But here's an oddity, and maybe some of you have been bothered by this, and it's something that we need to resolve. We know the size of data, and that's usually pretty small. An integer typically is about 4 bytes, 32 bits on a typical computer, so 4 bytes. And a bool is typically a single bit, but it's usually stored in the smallest unit of memory, so usually 1 byte. But code can be very big. The body of a program can be hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of lines. How could you possibly go ahead and put that much code inside of a data structure and manipulate it properly? And that's exactly the problem we seem to have with classes. Remember, I can go ahead and create a class by doing a new, and it has some data inside it. But how do I get a handle on how much memory I'm tying up with the code? Because if it has lots of methods in it and I have a number of instances of classes, it would appear that I'm going to be wasting space because the amount of memory used for a method might be quite substantial, hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands or megabytes possibly. Does anybody know the little trick they play? This is why it took so long for people to come along and said, hey, putting data and functions together is cool because functions operate on data and data have to have the appropriate functions. So they kind of, you know, like peanut butter and jelly, they go together pretty nicely. But why did it take people so long to figure out to do that? Part of the problem was, one, they didn't want to put all that code inside a piece of data and move it around. If I read it, assigned it, passed it as a parameter, I could be wasting lots and lots of time and memory for the code that it took for that body. So the question is, does anybody know the trick of how they ended up doing that? Well, it's the sort of situation here. If you ever go to the doctor and something, you go to the doctor and you say, hey, doc, when I do this, it hurts. What's your recommendation? Don't do this. So the question is, if it costs so much to put all that data inside the struct, what do? We don't put the code for the method inside the struct. This is purely a visualization. And when we get around to the final step, Project 5, we're going to have to implement it that way. If I go ahead and put a method, which is just a function, method is the fancy new name, I do not actually put the code for the method inside the struct. Actually, I do something that's kind of odd. Instead of that, logically it belongs here, but what happens is I create a new body of the function outside the class. If it's outside the class, I only make one copy of it. Therefore, if it's big, that's okay because I have to build the code somewhere and it's got to take some space somewhere. But what I do is I add an extra parameter that represents the struct or the class. So we turn things totally inside out. What looks like the fact that logically the function is inside the struct, when I actually implement it, the function is outside and the struct is passed in as data. And it's simply compiled so that I have access to this data inside the body via the struct or class I pass in. So historically, that's how it was implemented. But what we're talking about is symbol tables. So what I'm going to get back to is, how do we actually handle the fact that I can have lots of classes or lots of structs or lots of records that all have individual fields whose names might clash? Remember, in Java, there's no rule that says if you have class 1 and class 2 that I have to have different field names inside those classes. In fact, that'd be pretty terrible if I did, because you'd run out of all the cool names. You'd end up saying, well, I'm going to call this in count. Oh, no, you can't. This guy's already using count in his class. And I'm going to use sum. Oh, no, the woman down the hall is using it in her class. And you just run out of cool names. And you can certainly see that, you know, when you try to get a good login on something. Like, do they still have cool logins here? I mean, it used to be at the university. If you have anything at all like a common name, there's some Asian guys that have a name like Lin or Lu. It's never Lin. It's Lin 377 or Lu 432 or something. So it's, you know, it's bad. Do they have the same thing here, or can you actually use your own names, or are they starting to run out of names here too? So you can't just be Joe or Mary or Tom. You got to, if you have a pretty unusual name, right? Oh, that explains it something. Because I have a colleague of mine who now works here, whose name is her first name is Marvin, and his login is Marvin. And I was wondering, if Marvin, how he got away with it. So he's not the most tenured, but he's the most longevity. He's been walking the earth longer than most. Oh, I see. It just really 9,000 people, and there's only one Marvin. That's Marvy, too. But the other one came in later. Oh, cool. So I was wondering how that all works. And I thought maybe you put the fix in or something. Cool. So anyway, what happens here is we're not going to... What you see here is the notion of having what amounts to a common namespace, that as you get bigger and bigger, here you still have a chance if you're something like Marvin or something, I guess. Does anybody have an Elvis? And it's occasionally you're somebody special and you have these cool names. You're not, you know, there's not Elvis Smith or Elvis Jones. I guess there's an Elvis Costello, but there's only one Elvis to a lot of people, or there's particular names. Is Madonna still a thing? It used to be Madonna was special, because there's only one Madonna, but she's not so popular anymore. And there's some more recent ones. So if you have a unique enough name, that works. But what happens here is, although you realize that or not, when I have something like a class, I'm really having inside it, as I said, for our particular notion, a symbol table. And there are little symbol tables hiding all over the place in various implementations. So whenever I create something as simple as, going back to this thing right here, this thing has exactly three fields, I and B and F. The way I handle this is I create a little symbol table with just those three entries, and I can always tell the I, B, or F that belongs to this struct by first providing a qualifier that gives the name of the structure or the class. That's why oftentimes when you're talking about a class, you say C dot A. You say C is the name of a class. Go to its symbol table. Find the symbol table. Do a lookup of A inside that symbol table to figure out what field A or method A or whatever means inside that class. So if I had a second class with K, It could also have a field named A with no problem at all, because they would have separate symbol tables and the clash would be resolved. So that's rather the same as having very small organizations. If it was the case that it wasn't Epic dot something, but the various subdivisions inside Epic. So Epic dot quality assurance or something. Do they, what, they call that QA here, or do they give a different name? So you could have something like Epic QA, which had a smaller namespace, and therefore you'd be much more likely, if your name was Jim or Mary or Tom, to get your own name inside that limited namespace, because the QA would qualify what organization you were in and what organization you were not in. So even in everyday situations, that sort of issue comes up. So we're going to have symbol tables just for that. And here's just what I was saying ago. You worry about clashing, so you make the name local to the particular scope you have and qualify it. So reference x.a means look up x. X should have a type that supports a symbol table for local definitions. And then you look up a within x's symbol table and then have information about it. And that's how things like we were talking about earlier turn out to be working. How in the world do they qualify this thing, system.out.println, which unfortunately you have to write a lot, unless you perhaps have Eclipse do some sort of automatic typing for you, or put in some macro system like I talked about earlier as an abbreviation. So when you actually have a compiler that says system.out.println and then paren and some value to be printed, what it first does is system is looked up in sort of a series of global packages that says, okay, there is a system that's available to all users of Java. And it's a particular class that has a various number of members. One of them is out, so that's the standard output within the system that you're currently running in. And it's of type printStream. Because it's of type printStream, it knows the methods that are supported by that. So printStream is a class definition that has its fields and members defined. And inside printStream, there's a method member called printLine. So by doing it this way, it gives you some flexibility, although admittedly it's more complex. So you could, for example, have printLine defined inside some other class, and it might even have a different meaning. Sometimes people say print and printLine always mean the same thing, but they only mean the same thing in this case within the context of what the type of out is. In this case, out being a print stream has one definition of print line. Some other class might have a rather different definition. There's also the case of internal versus external access that I wanted to talk about. So now we're going back to classes where we have some functions. Remember, functions have scope. So in this case, we have subber that has a scope. But since it's defined inside class C, it has automatic access not just to its own local definition J, but it also has access to the shared definition outside it inside class C. So this is very similar to what you'll be doing in your language. If you happen to have class C as your entire CSX program, you can define a class I int, and inside a method, you don't have to say C.I. Rather, you say, since I'm sitting inside of a class, the default scoping is first look up I inside the method, subber. Not defined there. Take the next containing scope, which happens to be the body of the class. Look up I there. Yes, it is. So the I being assigned is the static int I. That's a field inside class C. So it works pretty much just the way we talked earlier, be we in Java or in CSX. And again, how do we do this? Well, we essentially do the block structured symbol table that we talked about previously. Notice the situation that what I showed about earlier, where you have incomplete definitions, things get a little bit dicier. So maybe we're kind of glad we don't have that. If it's a situation, if we look at the bottom, where I have integer f, but I don't give its body, but I want that body to be compiled as if it were sitting right where that integer f is, and in particular, it has access then to integer I. But when I get around to compiling that body, notice I'm outside of class C. So if I'm writing a compiler for this incomplete definition, that's why I have that C double colon. C is the name of a class. The double colon says, essentially go in and qualify or extend something inside class C, namely its F. And the way you extend it is by magically, or act as if it's magically, going into that class C definition and adding the return I as the body of F. But now when I compile it, notice I does not have a qualification C dot I. So I have to compile this as if I had reopened class C, made available its local definitions like int I, and then gone ahead and opened F and compiled it exactly as if it was sitting there. So it's one of these situations where you want this to behave as if it had been inside the class C, but you want to compile it separately when it's not, and that makes the compiler a little more difficult. You don't have to worry about that in your project. We don't have that there, but just a little sense of things have trade-offs, and sometimes when something's more flexible in one way, it's a little harder for implementers, and I think it is in this case. So this explains how it's all done. I won't spend any more time on that. We also have public and private access, and that's something that's fairly important in terms of security. So remember, you're allowed to have various fields and various methods be public or private. Private means they're accessible only inside the class. Public means they're accessible outside, typically by class dot and then the name of the publicly available item. So what do we do in terms of symbol tables? Well, what happens is when we're inside of a class, public or private doesn't mean too much. It's inside of a class, both public and private are accessible. So while we're compiling inside the class, and let's see if I have a little definition there, then if you happen to have some reference to something like I, it'll be accessible all the time. But if it's the case that I'm outside the class, I have to enforce the fact that if I is private, it's not accessible. So the way you do that is, if you have public versus private, when you store a field, you store this field that says also, are you public or private? As long as you're inside of a class, that qualification of public or private is irrelevant. But once you close the class and you say something like C.I, you really ask two questions. You say, is I properly declared inside C? You go into the symbol table for C, look it up. But even if you find it, you say, hey, is this guy public? If he's public, fine. If he's private, I have to give a message saying, sorry, a private field may not be accessed from outside the class. So public versus private is useful for programmers, but it does make type checking a tad more difficult. So then this is what I just said here. We have the two-step process where you tag on public or private and check for private if you're outside the class. Turns out C++ and Java also have a protected qualifier, I think C# does also, that allows subclasses to have access to a particular definition, but totally outside the class. So a subclass behaves as if it's partially inside the class and partially its own definitions. We don't have subclassing of that sort, so we don't have to worry too much about it. And that just explains what's going on there. Java also has something called blank access that allows public access by all classes inside a particular package. And we sometimes utilize that. So in Java, packages are groups of classes and interface definitions into units. So if you want to group classes together into some related issues, you typically put them in packages. The utility of package is that I can then talk about getting classes by giving a qualified name. So, for example, in the Java util package, there's a useful class called vector. And whenever I want it, vector is not automatically visible, but I can do this qualification that says java.util will end up giving me access to a package, and package will have a symbol table, and inside there will be the various classes that are accessible, and one of those is vector. So in that particular case, I can talk about it by giving a full qualification. And sometimes you're playing with a class path, you can do it that way. You also have import statements that affect how symbol tables do their lookup. So I can essentially go ahead here and say, import javautil.vector. The advantage of that is once I import it, vector can then be used without qualification anymore. It would simply say that vector now acts as if it were a local definition, but I have this pointer back to Java util vector to say we're actually defined the definition. I can also have this catch-all sort of thing that says, hey, I want to go ahead and have all the classes available in Java util potentially available. And the way these things will then work is that if I do a lookup and I don't have a local definition of something, it'll go into one of these catch-all definitions and saying, hey, he talked about vector. There's no local definition of vector. Maybe we should go into the import and see if there's a vector there. And if there is, that must have been the one he wanted, and we'll make it available. So notice all this is making symbol table lookup harder. The symbol table you're doing is pretty easy. Do a block structured symbol table, look up in the innermost scope, the next containing, up to and including the global scope. If it's not found in any of those, it's an error. If it is found, it's the innermost definition is the one you want. All these extend that lookup mechanism. Sometimes it's a handy thing to have, but it certainly makes checking more difficult. Another place where we find symbol tables, perhaps unexpectedly, are in class files and object files. That is, the actual class compilation creates a .class file, and inside there is a mini symbol table. That's how when I go ahead and call a class and I say I want method so-and-so in that class, it's able to verify that that method or that field is available and potentially has the correct access mechanism. So if you ever looked at a .class file, it's a little bigger than you might expect. And one of the reasons for that is it includes a little symbol table along with the code and all the data that a particular class needs. So we won't have to actually use this, but just the notion there that classes have the scoping built into the structure. So that when I put classes together and I take somebody else's class, I can say, okay, that class should have some particular method M. Go ahead and look it up and verify it exists and that its typing is correct. And what happens is the loader for Java verifies all this as classes are brought together to make sure that all the interfacing is proper. Okay, something we will have to worry about, and I'll let you kind of make your decision on whether this is useful or not. Turns out from time to time, people come up with new definitions or new concepts. Some of them succeed and some of them fail. So historically, for example, early languages like C and C++ allowed you to play with memory pointers. It's possible to take, for example, an integer and typecast it into a pointer into memory and do data access through that pointer. That's something that C sharp, except in very rare circumstances, disallows. It's certainly something that Java disallows, and it's something that it turns out that derivatives of Java like CSX disallow. In more advanced languages, the notion of having access to real memory pointers has been disallowed. Java has something called references, which are sort of control. So there's a notion of something that, hey, we'll let the user have a pointer, but it turns out that the decision has been that that's more and more dangerous. Does anybody have any experience of why manipulating pointers might be dangerous? Yeah, I heard a chortle here. Lots of reasons. The first reason, among all others, it's hacker's heaven, isn't it? If I can create a pointer or anything, that's like giving me the universal key. Now, I guess here it's kind of strange because a lot of places and a lot of doors don't lock. But on big campuses, I mean, situation there that the building manager has a universal key that will open any and all doors within the building. I don't think there's any universal keys for the entire campus. But letting one of those things get away is pretty dangerous. If I allow you as an ordinary programmer to synthesize an address, gosh knows what you're going after. And historically, a lot of the simpler hacking tricks had to do with using a language like C and building your own pointer. Even if everybody was good, all of a sudden, you know, just like we come on campus here and we're all very good. We don't smoke anymore. We don't drink adult beverages. We don't even drink sugared beverages. We only drink the purest of the pure, you know, pure mountain water or something. It's still a situation there. That if you're all perfect souls, there's another good reason not to allow access and manipulation of pointers. And this is not a negative where you do a bad thing. It's rather, if you do me a favor, I'll do you a favor. If you promise that you don't have access to pointers, what will I do for you? I'll give you garbage collection. And it turns out that Java and C Sharp and almost all modern languages have automatic garbage collection. What does that mean? That means that when you do go ahead and do news, do allocations of memory, in the old days, you had to give back the memory. If you didn't, in fact, some of you may have seen that, there used to be an old phenomenon called memory leaks. And memory leaks were what? Again, some old timers may have it. It's gotten rarer and rarer, and that's actually a good thing. But historically, what was a memory leak? Right. And you may notice that some programs have a little bit of that tendency still. What happens is, as programs run, they get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, you say, okay, that's doesn't matter so much. I'll just stop the program and reboot it, which is historically the fix. But it turns out that a colleague of mine had a class, an undergraduate class, and they went out to one of the local airports, and they were looking at the very software, and they were talking about various things, and one of the air controllers was there, and he was saying, oh, this thing is getting sluggish. We're going to have to reboot. And he asked, what's going on here? Well, yeah, this program, after it runs a while, gets sluggish and sluggish and sluggish, and it gets so bad that it can't be used anymore. Obviously, a memory leak. He says, oh, what do you do? Oh, we just shut down the system, reboot it, and start it up again. Now, you can imagine if they did that at O'Hare or Minneapolis, St. Paul, or one of the really major airports. You're flying along, and all of a sudden, their memory leak has gotten there. Oh, we're going to reboot the system. Please try not to crash for the next 5 minutes while we're rebooting the system. So what happens is, if you're not allowed to have access to the actual pointers, we'll talk about this towards the end of the semester, it's possible to have something called garbage collection, where a system determines for you what is usable and what is not, and will automatically throw away and reuse any memory that's no longer accessible by a program. That means that memory leaks, except in very rare circumstances, should be a thing of the past. You can still create memory leaks, but it's far less common. And that means that you can have programs that are much more long-lived. And again, I guess in your cases, if you had something that was a medical monitor or something, you'd want it to run long-term. In fact, I've always wondered, maybe you know the answer to that, that it's possible now to have medical devices implanted inside your body that are computer-controlled, things like pacemakers. Thankfully, I'm not at the stage where I have that. But I always wondered, how do you redo the software for something that's planted in somebody's body? You know, you say, oh, by the way, we found there's a little bug, you know, situation. If you go like this and go like that three times, the thing stops. Oh, my God, you know, don't. Huh? I don't know. But it doesn't have to be. Yeah, that's right. And one way would be a surgery. Take the one out and the other one in. But one of the things people are looking into now, this is an extreme case, is can you update programs on the fly? And people have actually done research, you may have done it here, is that you have a new update to a program, and it's running along, and it's controlling airplanes or controlling your heart, and you don't want either of those to go bad. You have a way to actually load the software without disrupting the program and kind of transition from the old into the new. There's lots of cool stuff being gone on, but one of them certainly requires the fact that you're able to distinguish between data and non-data. And that's something which the old languages didn't allow and the new languages do. So that's an example of something that is positive. You're not allowed to synthesize pointers. You only have references that are essentially controlled by the language. Here's another one which you have probably seen, and you may decide whether you like it or not. The old rule used to be everything had to be uniquely defined. But what happens is, in many languages, at least for the case of methods, it's a situation you have methods that are fairly similar and differ by some detail. In fact, they're similar in the sense of having the same name, and they differ in this example of having two versus one parameters. And this is a great example because as class-oriented programming came into play, it turns out there's two styles for doing methods. And I'm illustrating both of them here. So here we have a class C, and it has two different methods called sum. The first one takes two parameters, and I had to kind of squish it onto a new line to make it fit. And the other one takes only one parameter. Now, this is kind of odd because when I think about sum, I think about sum as adding two things together. And that's exactly what the first definition does. So a lot of people, particularly if they're schooled in the old style of programming, create a method that takes two parameters, the left value and the right value, sums them together. And this, by the way, is made to be static. Why? Well, we'll tell you in a minute. But there's a more egocentric sort of view that says, I'm the center of everything. So when you're talking about sum, you're not talking about two parameters, because if the sum doesn't relate to me, I don't care. So in this case, the bottom one says, sum who? Sum something, add something to me, because I'm the guy that counts. And notice the way that works is, it says, I have inside this class object an integer. And inside this class, integer X is the man or the gal. It's the one that really counts. And if you're adding, it's always relative to that particular magic value. And a lot of programming in Java and Java-related languages are this sort of egocentric thing that says, I'll have methods inside of a class instance. So in this particular case, notice it's talking about X, which is a local variable to the class. So different C's will have different values of X's, and therefore the meaning of sum in one class will be different than the meaning of sum in another class. Going back to the other version, it says I'm public. I'm sorry, it means it says I'm static. That means I don't care which instance I'm in. Logically, this version of sum, the top one, doesn't have to belong in any particular class C, because it's not talking about any of the local data. Notice the parameters int1, v1, and v2 are coming in externally. So this is the less egocentric way of programming. But from our point of view, we're allowing both of those, and we're saying, okay, the two definitions of sum will coexist. That's called overloading. And the rule will be in our language that the number or type of the parameters has to differ. So in this case, the number of parameters differ, 2 versus 1. And that means I can always tell if I do a sum. If I give one parameter, it's the bottom call. If I give two parameters, it's the top or intermediate call. So that's something we'll have to do, and overloading is something which has caught on fairly well. Certainly it's the case if you program Java to any extent, you notice having overloading of constructors is pretty handy. You have a default constructor that is just a normal one, and you can have variations that says, when I construct it, I want to set this particular value or this particular flag or something else. So you can imagine having a constructor that says the home language is English or French or German or Korean or Chinese or whatever it might be. And whenever you go ahead and do something, it'll be relative to that language. And then that's a nice thing. So that's an example. Here is another example where you can think of sum as being the mathematical version. Sum always adds two things. Or the egocentric version, it says sum always is relative to the center of the universe or the center of the class, which in this case is variable X. But we're going to have to consider then doing that, and our language does in fact have overloading because it turned out to be popular enough that I think people will continue to want it, and that means we're going to figure out how to support it. So how do you actually figure out how this is going to work? Here's an example where I go ahead and say, give me a new C and call sum of 10 on it. What happens is when I look up C, of course it says it's a new C, so this is class C. I go back to my earlier definition. It says, hey, there are two definitions of sum. Logically, what I do is I say, I'm going to try each of them. One will fail and one will succeed. Both can't possibly succeed because they have a different number of parameters. Both may fail, in which case I have an attempt to call a third variant, which may not exist. In this case, there is a variant that takes the sum of 10. That's the egocentric one, the one towards the bottom. So the type checker says, okay, you're creating a brand new object C. Its type is, of course, C. Look at the fields within it and methods. It's got sum. It's got two of them. Try the first one. It takes two parameters. Nope. Try the second one. It takes one parameter. Yup. It expects an int. It finds an int. Bingo. It's a winner. So that's logically what we're going to expect it to do. Things can be worse. There were some languages, like an early language called Ada, which people spent a lot of time on, but it's kind of faded away, that said, I could resolve overloading not just by the number and type of parameters, but also by the result type. In some ways, that'd be pretty cool. Maybe when you first learned overloading, you thought that's the way it worked. But that would mean, for example, if I were allowed it, I could have an int temp. This would be something that would go into the system and say, what's the current temperature? It may be temperature in a room or the temperature on the motherboard or whatever. And operating systems really do that. There is a way to check temperatures. And if the system is getting too hot, it starts shutting things down to avoid frying the system. But you could imagine also having a float temp. That we return a fraction thing. So again, you know, if you're doing medical sort of things, what's the magic number? 98.6, right? So if you got 98.6, you're fine. If you're above it, you're feverish. If you're below it, what's the word for having a temperature below? Feverish is too hot. What's the term for too cold? Non-feverish? Hypothermic. Yeah, see? Yeah, you hang around doctors long enough, you get all these scares. Yeah, hypothermic. That's cool. So it'd be nice to have these two things coexist, and it would say when you want an inch, you get an inch. When you want a float, you want a float. And the way the system would work is there, if I had something like my temp equals temp of nothing, it would say, how could it figure out which of these two it was? It would go into my temp and look up its definition and say either it's a float or an integer, or it's convertible or not, and choosing which one is assignable, it would go ahead and do it. Turns out the general usage of this is way more complex. Right. Well, first of all, you'd of course check the parameters and decide which of the definitions were matching that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's actually a very clever algorithm from an old class of mine from way, way back, a guy named Ted Baker, called Baker's algorithm, having nothing to do with bread. Situation. And what it amounts to is try all possibilities. What you essentially do is, within the context of the analysis, which is typically a single statement, if it's got three possibilities, and remember, it could be called in many places, you try all the combinations and exactly one can work. And what it does is it has some very smart ways of figuring out that certain combinations can't work and you don't explore them. So it's way more complex than people want because, as you say, you can have context kind of intervening. And and just imagine if I had something like a temp, as you said there, took another temp. So and it gets there. So what we're going to start doing now is not having it overload not just respect to integer or float, but in terms of Celsius versus Fahrenheit. I don't know, what's the magic number? You must do it. 98.6 is within Fahrenheit. What's the magic number in Celsius that the doctors always worry about? 32 something? I'm not an MD, but it's something you know like that. So you can have a situation where now it's not just the fraction or non-fraction, but also which scale you're on, and have those try to coexist. And in fact, they've tried to do that in some cases where you have some units that are metric and some that are imperial. So you know, you add a meter to a foot, and what do you get? You know, a mess in that sort of situation. So the upshot is that this has been explored, and what they settled on for the most part is having a notion that the number and type of parameters, but not the result type, is the thing that determines. So in this case, we don't look at what sum's going to return. We look at its parameters. Got to be exactly one of those. Then we look at its type and say, is the type acceptable in the context? Okay. Compile time. It's all compile time. But it's potentially an exponential algorithm unless you tone it down, because when you try all combinations, that's one of those things that should ring a bell in every computer person's head. Because all combinations can be a lot. And computers are fast, but you don't realize how slow they can be until you try all combinations. Something else you may not have thought about, but something that may come into play, and you can kind of decide as enlightened customers whether it's something you like or not. In some languages like C++, you can overload operators. And notice that Java has already done a little bit of that in the sense that it has a plus operator that does not just integer arithmetic and floating point arithmetic, but also plus operator does what else? concatenation of strings. And in some sense, it's one of these things with operators, you have this sort of notion that adding is some notion of combining. But again, it's a little bit tricky because I don't know if people have ever been confused, but if I had something like in Java, I could be, and not knowing the language well, first of all, what does that mean in real Java? It's plus, but the double quotes mean, of course, this is a string. We just said strings allowed. And 10 plus 20 in Java strings is what? 10, 20. You know, it's concatenation. But you can imagine that. People say, well, wait a minute, those are numbers. And here's the case where you don't want to carry away. You would not give a definition of this. If the strings are numbers or digits, then it's arithmetic as we know it. Otherwise, it's concatenation as we know it. Because if those are variables, and oh my gosh, you know, you can imagine all the sorts of funny that. So, but Java's gone ahead and done that. It did it. Why can't you? And the notion is, should we, and maybe in some cases we do something similar to what we see in C++. What they do is say the number of operators and their precedence and all the stuff you worried about in Project 3 is predefined. All that happens is that when you have these predefined operators like plus and minus and star and slash, these are simply abbreviations for built-in functions. Remember, we talked a little bit about that when we did something like A plus B, that's the way we read it as following mathematics. But really, it's compiled as if it were that. So what Java is saying, I'm not Java, but C++ is, why can't we go ahead and give a new definition to plus for brand new types that haven't been invented yet? And going back to our example here, if you can do it for integers and do it for floats, maybe you're in a context where complex numbers are important. Certainly it's the case, I think, in electrical engineering. Any EE majors here? Electrical engineering, I think complex numbers are used a lot. There's a situation for power systems and all that. And why can't I create a type complex that mimics complex numbers and looks as uniform as possible with respect to other kinds of numbers? And here's how we go about doing it in C++. The key advantage here is that I'm allowed to take a pre-existing operator, like plus, I prefix it with the word operator to say, I really mean the code associated with the operator plus. So if I just wrote plus down there, I'd get a scanning or parser error because plus would be out of context. But they go ahead and extend the rule that says an identifier may have an operator plus or minus as part of it as long as, you know, it's in the context of an operator. So think of operator plus or operator minus as maybe being a reserved word or something. It looks like a combination of two things, but it's really one. And it says whenever you see a plus that takes a pair of complex numbers, one of them is the class and the other is the parameter, go ahead and call this method. And of course, if you remember your algebra in that case, the way you handle simple things like complex numbers is the real parts add together and the imaginary parts add together to give you the sum of a complex number. So it says execute the code in the body. But then the cool part is if I define C and D at the bottom as complex, I can write down just as if plus were predefined. So it turns out that that's something that we may see in other languages. In some cases, it's handy. In other cases, it's not. The trouble is if you try to pull an operator too far along, like suppose I had plus not just for complex numbers, but for personnel records. What does that mean? You know, situation, personnel record one plus personnel record two. Is it the old situation like the pair got married in a situation, or like the old thing you say, like Mary plus Bill, you know, carved in a tree or something like that? Or what would it mean? And that's part of the problem is that when you pull an operator beyond its pre-declared domain, it sometimes is not intuitive what it means. But it's a cool thing to be able to do. One thing that people have been experimenting with, and turns out that although it looks cool at first glance, in fact, you might love it, is you can create brand new operators by giving them new names. So, for example, some people experimented with I could create an operator like that. And what I would do is I would go ahead and declare a brand new character sequence for an operator, which the scanner would have to handle, And I could then, having defined this, write down an expression like that. Now, the cool thing is I get these brand new symbols, which nobody has ever seen before. The bad thing is, what the heck do they mean? This one isn't too bad. There's a variation. Sometimes people do that. Sometimes they do that. And one or the other. Can anybody guess what that might mean? Excuse me? Maybe no, but actually something even easier, simpler. Interchange. Notice that in programming, if you want A to get B and B to get A, so it's kind of, you know, like the arrow both ways. Once you know it exists, it's not so bad in one or the others. So you could do something like that. Incredibly what? Yes. But again, you can carry it away. I mean, now situations here, you know, if they create something like, what in the world does that mean? You know, ugh. It means whatever you want. It's really like, you know, somebody's writing in a totally foreign language. And that's the danger. So we probably won't go that far, but programming languages are always pushing the fringes to find out what cool ideas work and what cool ideas. Like, I really think this interchange is cool. As I said, it's something where most languages don't have, and yet it's common enough that it's something that would be worth having. And if I could define it myself, I'd go ahead and do it. But pushing it much beyond that gets harder and harder, because this one kind of makes sense, but getting more complex ones that make sense visually is really difficult, I think. But maybe someday people will do it. Maybe the trouble is I'm thinking too linearly. Now, what do they call these things, you know, where you on your iPhone where they have little smiley faces and grimaces and hands and all that? And what's the name on those? What is it? Say it. Emojis. Yeah, those are that. Imagine what you could do if you could create programming symbols with emojis. I don't know. It sounds crazy, but maybe it works. Apparently, it's very popular, you know, in some contexts, and people make sense of it. Maybe we could, as programmers, maybe that would be your contribution to the future. You're the emoji king or queen of programming. Wouldn't that be something? It would be something, but I don't know what. So anyway, that's something, again, we're not going to do it, but I just wanted to point you out that there are all kinds of possibilities. So finally, we'll go to contextual resolution, and then we'll move on to something nearer and dear to your heart, namely how to do Project 4. So in this situation there, most languages allow some degree of overloading. The question again is, how much do we allow? Again, human languages allow for a lot. And as I said, sometimes, you know, that can be misleading or complex, simply because the same word can mean different things. And most of you are native speakers, but anybody who doesn't have English as their first native language, it must be terrible getting all these things, you know. Like, what is LEAD? It's lead. No, it's not lead, it's lead. What? Lead is verb. No, it's not. Lead is a noun. And, you know, on and on and all that. So, again, I wasn't invented that way. But how much do we want to allow of reuse of symbols in a programming context? One thing I've showed you that exists is overloading of method names. That's fine. Let's look at another one. And this one is one you're pretty comfortable with, and you may never even realize you had this degree of overloading. Here's a case where in the bottom line, I have two things in red. They're different things with the same name. But it's not really quite overloading, because the thing on the left is not a method. It's a class. But remember, we have this notion that every class has inside it potentially a constructor, or maybe multiple constructors, but at least one. And a constructor looks like a method call. In fact, how can we tell that C of 10 is a constructor call and not a method call? As we're going to see later that, excuse me? No, actually, there's an easier way to tell. It has to have the magic word new in front of it. The only way you can ever make anything into a constructor call is by putting new in front of it. So in this case, you have this sharing, but it's pretty normal, and nobody really gets too confused. Yeah, okay, you know, as you say, this is really class, and I'm putting parameters around class, and classes in the context of parameters become, in this particular case, a case of a constructor. But as we'll see in a minute, I can also have a method with that name too. So it's really important that we realize the new plays a part. In older languages, there's all kinds of overloading and reuse. In Pascal, for example, you did not use a return statement. What you did is assign a return value to the name of the method. So if I was computing sum, I would say sum equals A plus B. And that says when you return, the most recent assignment to the name of the method or function was the return value. That was kind of cool, but it just never caught on, and return is the way people are still working things. Java, although it tries to keep it simple, actually has a fair number of different possible overloadings. You can have a class name, which is a type, a constructor, I just showed you that, a package name, which is kind of irrelevant, and we don't use packages too much, but you can also share a method and a field. So look at that thing in the middle. They all, it's legal Java code, and they're all definitions of C that are different. There's a C up top that's the name of a class. There's a C a couple of lines down that's essentially a constructor. Inside class D, there's a field named C, but notice it's also in the case that it has access to the class C because it has a call, use of C right below it. It has a method that's not a constructor. That's where the new versus non-new comes into play, that exists called C. And then there's a call at the bottom of the class C, C-val is new constructor of C, C being an integer, and C of empty parens being a function call. And all that coexists. I don't know if they carry things too far or not, but that's the rules in Java. What are the rules we have, which is more to the point? Well, in CSX, we're going to only have very limited reuse. We're going to have overloading of method names. And one other thing that I didn't used to have different, but now it just is the case that it kind of begs for a change, is that a label. What's a label? It's something that appears on a while loop, and it's used only in the context of a break or a continue. It turns out a label name can have any name it wants, any identifier name it wants, without any confusion. So what that's going to mean is when we talk about this, label names do not go into the symbol table. Rather, they go on a list of accessible names representing while loops that are currently being processed. Why is that? Well, it turns out that there's no basis confusion. Something on a label is always on a while, and the only thing you can do is break or continue. If I have other things with the same name, it doesn't matter, because when I see a break or continue, it's got to be a label. Which label? Well, I just checked my nesting. It's the nearest label around. That means, interestingly enough, that in our language, we can reuse the same label on while loops over and over. Without any confusion. Because you don't have to reuse the same name, and that gives you control over which loop you're talking about. So let's talk about this first, and then that is really an important one. So how do I figure out this thing? This is not wrong. Because remember, we have this notion of scoping with the nearest definition being the one that applies. So if I say break L, which loop am I breaking out of? The innermost one. But I can also put a break up here. Which one is it now breaking out of? Not the innermost one, because it's not in that loop. It can't break out of a loop it's not in. So it's the intermediate one. And in this case, it's the outer one. So the question is, you can allow it, but you know, why have labels at all was a valid question. And it's because now, if I am more sensible, it's a situation there where now this break can break out of the innermost one by saying L3, or the intermediate one saying L2, or the outer one saying L1. And I kind of like that because that is more like truth in advertising in terms of breaks are used infrequently enough that saying which one you want to break out of is good documentation. No, if you break out of L1 up top here, you're never in L2 or L3. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah, that's right. You break out of the intermediate ones, too. That's absolutely correct. Okay, so let me just... I heard a little buzzer there. So what we're going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit next half hour about type and kind because it's very important in our project. And then I'm going to go back to the project and start talking about the various rules that we have in our language. What I've been talking about here are general sort of rules that are going to have an application in our language. So why don't we take about 10 minutes and reconvene for our final session about 10 of. We'll talk a little bit about this and then talk about the project.